Soros. Hát igen, fölhívott. Hogy szokott elkezdődni? Szólni kell nekik vele? Tessék? Negyed óra. Thank you. Okay, so in the previous section of the talk, we were talking about how you can localize the specific regions in the brain which might have different functional role in vision or any other cognitive function. Now, you can go a step further and you can try to use fMRI to study the information processing in these different specific regions and how they are connected to behavior. So that's the most important thing here, is to try to connect behavior to specific brain networks or specific brain regions. And now if you talk about function, of course, you are talking about how the information is processed. And again, we know a lot about monkeys, how visual information processing takes part. And it has a very important feature. It's very efficient and very fast. So basically, if you have a task, or if you give a task for a monkey to detect an object or a face in the environment, the monkey will perform this task extremely fast and efficient. So basically in 100 milliseconds there will be already specific, category-specific, object category-specific signal in the visual cortex and also in the frontal lobe. So the information is very efficient, very fast. And this is very similar in humans. So basically it takes about 100 milliseconds or 150 to say that there is a car in this picture. And if you have to say that what kind of car is this, it's a Volkswagen or a whatever, Mercedes, then it will take you about 200 milliseconds. So basically, within 200 milliseconds, the brain can process and code all the important information which is required for a visual, discrimination or detection task. Ah, here it is, the main steps. But so if this is the case only if the objects are very clean, the objects are not deteriorated, not noisy. So if you want to design an algorithm to be able to do object detection or discrimination, there are plenty of them and they are very good if the images are, a separate image somewhere on the screen. So that's very easy. You can even get a rotation invariance, you can have many different properties. But as soon as the image is getting closer to what's naturally is, present in your environment, of course, this is a specific situation where you have this, washed out images and faces are very difficult to code properly. And that has been investigated in monkeys, and we know that then you have to have some additional processing in the brain, in the visual system, and This is actually nicely captured by the model of the visual system and basically the model of the whole cognitive functioning. I don't know whether you heard about the predictive modeling and predictive coding. No? Okay, then it's not going to be very easy, but the idea is, and we will talk about this later, is that the brain is not a photo a camera, that we know. Okay, eyes are not cameras. But what we know by now, that the brain has a very nice and exact model of the environment. So this is why the development takes so long. So if you look at the kid, 2 years old kid, they are very simple model in their mind about the world. So as we grow up, it's getting more and more complex. It's even visually so. As you can, you know, you probably have experiments, and when a child starts to read or learn letters, B or D is completely the same. The orientation of the, you know, lower part of B and D, it's very difficult for them to get that, okay, this is left, this is right. So it's striking how slowly this whole system builds in your brain. So the idea is that vision is experience, vision is basically making predictions and decisions about your environment. So it's not one by one representation, it's trying to get the gist, the most important part of your visual environment, and predict it and make decisions. And this is nicely captured by the predictive coding theory, which assumes actually that perception itself is like a recurrent process. So the brain always predicts what it's going to, you know, see, what is going to be the next image, because we are not disconnected from our environment, so we are continuously. If you know that we are in this room, your visual system is going to activate this model that you are, you know, within a room, these are walls, these are chairs, and these are tables. So that's going to be set active in your brain, and this is how you predict what's going to happen next. When you remove your eyes, if someone, you know, raises voice and look at there, you know that this is going to be a face. So this is prediction. Now what happens if the images are noisy is basically, one idea is that what you do, or the brain does, is needs another reverberating, you know, cycle. Another prediction. So you get a noisy image, the first estimation is very poor, a lot of, you know, prediction errors. So what was predicted is not exactly what we have in your environment, because it's a noisy face. You don't have a good template for a noisy face, so you have to redo this cycle, predict again, and as long as you get a good estimation and a small prediction error. Now, we wanted to test that. This is one of our experiments that we performed recently. I would like to show you how we use fMRI to study brain and study visual function. And you get an idea about what is fMRI in real experiment. And so we took faces because, as I mentioned you, this is the face network. This is the FFA, what I already said. And these are the two other regions which are closely connected to face processing. So you can localize this in the brain very easily. And we know a lot of electrophysiology about how faces are processed. And you can do image manipulations that will deteriorate your, you know, perception. So this is a clean image. And you can add phase noise. Phase noise is basically phase randomization of the image. It's used in image, you know, processing, and it's a well-known technique. It basically deteriorates your contour information. So it's getting more and more difficult to say whether it's a given person or even to say whether it's a male or a female face. So this is how you can manipulate the image to evoke different perceptual processes in the brain. And this is very nice because it's parametric. So by giving a certain percentage of noise, you can regulate nicely performance. And so you basically, what you can do, you can set up an experiment where these are the clean, intact faces. So it's very easy to say that this is a female, this is a male face. Now, by morphing these two faces together, you saw in advertisements, you can basically morph a female face into a male face, and then there is in between them, you can have this androgenic, this very, you know, gender-wise not characteristics phases. And so it's very difficult to say this is female or male. Now you can again do the task very difficult by adding the noise. So basically you have two conditions here. However, here it's not that you are not predicting the image properly, it's just the difference, you know, they are so close to each other in the face space, as we call. Here, on the other hand, you have to invoke some other processes which will take care of the noise in your brain. So that was basically the idea what we did. And you can see how nice with performance of the subjects, of the participants can be manipulated. So this is the intact phase, male-female discrimination. So they are almost 100%. So this is the correct responses. The one is 100%. But in these two conditions, they are impaired. So they are only 70% correct, but they are very similar, both in the EEG experiment and in the fMRI. So they performed an fMRI and an EEG experiment. And accordingly, as the task gets harder, the reaction time will be increased. So you can see that there is an increase in the reaction time when you do this discrimination as compared to this. Okay, so this is very important. So you manipulate and you control the behavior. This is the only way how you can measure properly functional processes in the brain using fMRI. If the performance is not controlled, you never know what is going to actually, what you're going to see in the image. So this is just EEG, just to confirm that, because we are interested in timing of these processes. So fMRI gives you a poor resolution, temporal resolution, but a good spatial resolution. So you can combine EEG, you know what is EEG, right? So you can combine EEG with fMRI, and then you can map actually the dynamics and the spatial organization of this visual information processing steps in the brain. And this is well known that you have this P1, this is 100 milliseconds after you present the face, there is a big component here. Then you have the 100-170, which is actually sort of face component. By 170 milliseconds, the face already clearly signals you that, okay, there is a face. This is very nice component, it's big and it's strong. Now, what we found here, that there is another component, it's 50 milliseconds later, or 60, which is this one, which is increased for noise, but not for the morph condition. Then you make the task difficult just by morphing these faces together. You don't have these components, and neither this one you did. But we did some other control experiments which showed that this is the critical component, this P2, 230 milliseconds after the presentation, which actually is specifically invoked by the noisy faces. And it's basically nicely corresponding with one of the cycles of these predictions, because it's about 50 milliseconds. So basically what happens here is that brain cannot judge whether it's a female or male face by 170 milliseconds. So it does another prediction, okay, but what happens? How this prediction is done? And we thought, okay, maybe you need some other areas in the visual system to get involved, because the face processing network is very poorly organized spatially. So there is not much spatial information in it. But when you wash out, when you deteriorate the contours in the image, you have to have a system, a mechanism, which will somehow reconstruct these contours. And actually, this is what happens if you look for the fMRI results. So if you nicely balance the two conditions, I mean, when you make that task more difficult by morphing and noisy, you can see that the only, if you contrast them, you can have only one area activated. This is extremely rare in this kind of experiments. But it was not the only one in the brain, but it was only one in the visual cortex. And that was a lateral occipital cortex, which is a region in the brain which is object selective. It's not face selective, it's selective for different, you know, like these objects. But what is very important, it's still retinotopically organized. As I said to you, that in the early visual cortex, everything, all the areas are retinotopically organized.
And then as you go move up in the hierarchy, you lose this retinotopic organization. And this is a region in the brain which is intermediate in between the retinotopically organized and non-retinotopic. So basically what it says that there is spatial information to recover this contour information. So basically, combining EEG and fMRI, you can take a specific visual processing step, a visual processing function, and you can localize it both in time using EEG and in the visual, in the cortical space, that means in which region it happens, and that's the lateral occipital cortex. And what is important here now that we already have now an EEG system which can be taken into the MR system. So basically you can combine now that these experiments were performed separately. So one in the MR system, one in the scanner, one is outside in the EEG room. So now you can do this kind of experiment simultaneously. Put up the electrodes, take the patient or the subject to the scanner, and you can measure simultaneously the dynamic and the localization, the topography of the information processing in the brain. Now, here comes the resting state functional connectivity. Okay, we saw it nice, we have a region, we have a specific function for it. But again, it would be nice to see how this works as a network. And for that, it was important that previous findings showed that actually the whole visual cortical organization is reflected in this resting state functional connectivity. So you have stronger connections between retinotopically organized areas than non-organized areas and so on and so on. So basically we repeated the same experiment, but now we are looking for resting state fMRI. So the subjects perform this task, the noisy and the, it's a three-phase discrimination task now because of other reasons, but the point is to say which is more different from the other two. I think this is more different than these two. So it's again an important face identity discrimination task. And then you map the specific regions, like the FFA, which is the face region, and the LOC, which we found in previous experiments that it is specifically involved in the processing of noisy faces. Now what you can see first is even though LOC is involved, this lateral occipital cortex, in discriminating the noisy faces, the decision will be made based on FFR representation, the functional. So you can see the behavior is nicely correlating in the activity for noisy faces in the FFA. This is the fusiform face area. But more importantly, if you take this small network, so you localize the two LOCs, one in the left and one in the right hand, left and right hemisphere, and the two FFA, and you measure just the resting state connectivity strengths between these regions, so basically the subjects are just lying in the scanner, then just based on how strongly they are wired and connected together, you can nicely predict how the patient is going to perform in a face discrimination task, which is quite amazing, I think, because what you basically say is that I can map your behavior and your cognitive abilities based on just, you know, how your resting brain is communicating with each other. So that when I said that it's a very powerful and very exciting technique, this resting state, these are the examples which show you that, yes, this is indeed the case. And if you now take this model, how you do it, to, you know, clinical cases or disease models, then you can, so the idea is that you, at some point you can just look at the resting brain and say, okay, this patient is going to have a specific problem with memorizing faces, a specific problem with episodic memory or declarative memory, and that now is actually reality. So you can do this kind of task based on this methodology. So just to conclude, this is how you apply fMRI to study both you know, task-related and functional connectivity, resting state fMRI, to study a specific function in the brain during, you know, vision and specific visual task. Now, another very important characteristic of the visual system and the brain, which I already mentioned before, is it's not taking pictures, right? I'm sorry, I a little bit forgot what is in my talk, but it's going to come back. So I run a little bit fast, but anyway, so So starting with Helmholtz, already the models of the brain and the models how we see actually had this concept of making inferences or making predictions. That's how the brain works. And that was very different from what, you know, during the development of brain research is actually in the 90s and 2000. It was a completely different, you know, approach. Everybody was talking about computers. Let's try to model brain as a computer. So a binary system, you know, one or zero. But if you go back to Helmholtz, who was probably one of the biggest brain researchers in the world in the past, you can see clearly all these ideas which then developed into this prediction coding model that I already mentioned. And this you can see easily in the different illusions. You probably know that what we see is objectively, physically cannot be measured. You must have seen this illusion already. It's just so striking, I show you. So if you have this and this area, that no way you can say that it's the same brightness, right? But now if you put two bars next to it, you will see that yes, they indeed are the same brightness. It's just that your brain considers this region to be in the shadow of this object. So if you measure the same, or the brain measures the same brightness from this and this, and this is in the shadow, that means that this might be much brighter than this one. And indeed, this is the case. So you perceive it much brighter than that one. So what does it tell you? It tells you that the whole visual system is making inferences and based on the past. So we have this inherent built-in models of the world, in these routines, how you perceive the brain. And it would be very nice to be able to see how this is actually organized in the brain. And that was one of the biggest challenges what, you know, functional imaging was trying to address. So the whole concept comes, actually it's quite ironic that when vision started to move towards this active vision and prediction coding models, it was actually generated mainly or triggered by the computer vision community, when the first real machine vision algorithms were trying to put together the first machine vision algorithm and the whole idea that we can do an artificial visual system, they just simply realized that it's impossible because the idea was that you have to map pixel by pixel the whole environment. So as you know, we see 180 degrees to, you know, some extent, but it's so much information that no way you can code it, all of them. And that was clear that the brain doesn't do it. So you know from you know, electrophysiology and anatomy that we have color vision only in the center of fixation. I mean, like 10, 15 degrees. Outside, we don't see color. We don't perceive it as we are not seeing them. That's the biggest, that's called the big illusion of the vision, that what you don't see, you don't perceive it not being seen. That's the critical question. This is why we are fooled by our system to be not bothering about, you know, what we see and what we don't see, as you don't see the back of your head. So you don't see blackness in behind of your head. So that's clearly an adaptive system which takes care only the relevant information. Because, you know, if you take natural images, most of the part of the image is actually redundant or not relevant. So if you go to a forest, or, you know, you see all these images, they are repeating patterns, so you don't have to code all of them simultaneously to be able to get the gist of the screen. The other question is, of course, why it is so full and why you perceive it so nice. This is because of the memory. We are not going to go into details, but you are moving your eyes, sampling the environment, and basically your memory keeps track of it and gives you the illusion that you see everything. You see all the small wooden panels on the wall, which is not true, of course. And so this is the active vision concept, and the question is whether you can study this with fMRI, and how you can study this with fMRI. And of course, the first question was, which is a critical question, which is often which is often disregarded by vision scientists, that our eyes are never stable. So we are doing three, four saccades. Saccades are eye movements in a second. But we don't see the world moving, right? So we don't, if you do a visual, you know, if you take a camera and you will move it just as your eyes are moving, and you will look for the movie, what was recorded, it will be extremely strange. So it's gonna be very, very disturbing, because you will see all these shifts. But the brain takes care of this, because it actually cancels the information what is between the eye movements, what is during the eye movements, actually. Now, and how active is vision, and how it is important to have that, you know, the most important part of it, and how the experience shapes it. So this is the eye movement pattern, what you get if you ask a subject to look at this, you know, this is Machu Picchu, and you say, okay, just, you have 10 seconds, watch this picture, because then you will have a question about it. And this is the, so you see these lines are eye movements, these are the fixation points. So you have a quite, you know, random fixation. Of course, it's localized to mainly to the important parts of the picture. But now if you show them that this is actually a face, so you can see it as a face image, this is what you will get. So after seeing that this is a face, the people can't stop producing a face eye movement pattern. So basically, independently of the orientation of the face, if I look at your face, this is what my eyes are doing. So I will sample your eyes most strongly, your mouth, and of course your nose, blah, blah, blah. But that's the most important. So you all almost have no fixations on your cheeks or your other parts which are irrelevant. These are actually the diagnostic part of an image, because face eyes tell you best the age, the gender, and a lot of other things. Mouth tells you a lot about your emotions, of course, if you are smiling, that's the critical, you know, point. And also the whole structure, the distance actually between the nose and the mouth and the eyes is a critical distance. So in face, this is one of the building, you know, component of face symmetry. So it's very important. So you judge faces sympathetic or nice if this ratio between these three main parts of the face are according to your experience. So what scientists have done is they generated an average face. So you basically can take from the internet 1 million pictures of a face. You can align them similarly and morph them together. So you can basically make one image out of the 1 million image you collected from the internet, and this is gonna be an average or mean face. And it turns out that this mean face, you can look for it on the internet, I don't think I have one. This is basically the face which is regarded the most, the nicest and most pleasant face what you can imagine. If you do an experiment and you ask the participants to judge how this face is trustful, nice, blah, 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 they will say that the average face is the most. So basically what is in your brain, you have a mean face representation, all the faces you encountered, and that's the origo, that's where you start, and around this you build a face space. And this face space actually is conditioned, it's like how far is the face in different directions. This is gender, this is age, how far it is from mean face. And this, you can code the whole face business. Yeah, I don't know why I told you. Anyway, we are talking about optic vision, and so if you are looking for active vision, you have to realize that the critical component, in addition to eye movements, is your attention. Now, attention is easy if you go home and you try to fixate on the clock in the center, and you can, just without moving your eyes, you can read all these, you know, numbers on the clock one by one. So you can map them with your attention without moving your eyes. You can see clearly that if I want to attend to 3, I will see 3, but I won't see the 11, the 9, no, number 9. So you can, by attention, you can map the space and map the features. And okay, so if you take attention as a component of the active behavior, then you have three components. There is an alerting component, that means that you are, you know, the level of arousal. You are very, 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 you know, active, that's good. If you want to do a task, that's important. But this is a different system from what is a specific orientation in the space, in the feature space. So I'm expecting something from the left, then you are orienting to the left. As you are driving, of course, you are orienting to most specific and important parts of the environment. And then there is an executive function, and this is actually which develops slowest and decays fastest. So that's the critical point. We actually have quite some projects on this with aging. But executive functions are basically those functions, again connected to attention, which organize your behavior. So as you attend to different parts of the input, you the same way attend to different components of your mental, you know, inner representation. So you can attend to specific memories, you can attend to specific motor programs, you can prepare yourself to different, you know, behavior acts. And this is the executive function, because it's usual, it's not only one action which is required. So you have to prioritize, you have to solve the conflict. So should I bring this, or should I take with my right or left hand, what is the competition between, blah, blah, blah. So this is the executive function. So these are the three big systems which have been known from, again, from monkey literature and from neurology, because the vision studies nicely map this into the cortical space. So the first experiments that were performed actually with fMRI were looking how the brain actually orients towards different visual, say, visual inputs in the environment, and how the brain guides eye movement and attention. And what turned out, actually, not surprising, but there is a very tight connection between moving your eyes and moving your attention. It's just, attention is faster. So about 40, 50 milliseconds before your eye is going to land on an object, your attention is already there and preparing the processing of this object. So that can be nicely mapped with fMRI. And actually, still, you can differentiate some of the subparts of this network. This is the frontoparietal attentional network, which I showed you already with resting state functional connectivity, that you can map this. And this can be nicely mapped and studied now, which is very important because it has very important clinical applications. I will show you a little bit later. But again, there is a proof now. So we say, okay, it's the frontal eye field. That's how the region called here. So if you stimulate here, the monkey's receptive fields, neurons in the visual cortex will enhance their activity. Meaning that this is, you can basically simulate the same thing as attention in a model of the brain of a monkey. But what is also, as I said, it's important to somehow make the whole percept continuous. This is the subcade-related activity in the brain. And what you can see here that as soon as your eye starts to move, you have a blockade of the activity in the visual cortex. So basically, during the eye movements, your brain is shut down in a way, visual cortex. So not to disturb with all these moving, you know, parameters, the whole processing. And in addition to this, your receptive fields are also moving, but that takes us farther. Okay. Another important aspect of this is that basically, you can have a pure top-down signal. So what bottom-up signal is what is capturing your vision when you have a car is coming from your right and your attention is going to be captured and you start to looking at this. And you will have enhanced activity in the brain, in the visual cortex. Now, what you can see, you can cut the corpus callosum in the back of the brain, which connects the two visual cortical hemispheres, visual cortical areas. And what you can see is actually you can induce activation in the visual field, which actually is not bottom-up activated, just by feedback connection. That's again nice of that. Yeah. And the clinical relevance of all this, why it is important to map the visual attentional function, is because of a fortunately quite rare symptom, which is called functional neglect. So in these patients, what you have, it's a very strange symptom, because they basically disregard one of the half of the visual field. So anything what happens, what falls on the left side of the visual field, that basically for them doesn't exist. It can be only visual, and then they don't see if something happens in your left visual. But it can also have motor aspects. So when they are shaving, they will just not shave simply their left side of the face. And this is a quite devastating, you know, condition, of course, and it happens after stroke quite often. And there was a very, very interesting phenomenon. A subpopulation of these patients who have special topic neglect, they actually recover after some time, and the other one will remain in this neglect condition for a much longer time. And when people started to apply fMRI to study neglect patients, of course the prediction was, okay, here I have this dorsal attentional system, the F and the parietal cortex, and since you are not seeing something, or not, you know, noticing something in your left visual field, even when you are asked to go there and try to attend there, everybody thought that this might be some kind of attentional problem, and a lesion in this region would be indicated as a, you know, or predicted as a cause of this symptom. Now, what turned out that there is a large population of patients where the lesion is actually below of this dorsal attentional network. It's actually in the so-called ventral attentional network, which was quite surprising, and this has been known from neurology before, of course. And using fMRI, Corbetta and Schumann, they nicely could map this, that whenever you have a lesion in this ventral attentional system, actually you get the neglect syndrome just because the connection between two networks, the ventral and the dorsal attention, they are impaired. I mean, they are temporarily dysregulated, because these are strongly connected. After a lesion here, this region is going to be, you know, they have, there is going to be an effect on it as well. So it's temporal, it goes away after a while because there is a regularization, and then the symptoms will go away. But those who have lesions in the dorsal field, they will stay neglected for a longer time. So basically, one of the oldest questions, you know, in neurology, which was quite, you know, a big puzzle, has been solved basically with the help of fMRI, and now it is used quite commonly in good neurology departments in the world to make a good diagnostics of the and prediction for the recovery of these patients after a stroke. Yeah, of course, using fMRI you can also use or study the different components of attentional, how attentional, you know, the mechanism affects the visual information processing. These are two, three different components. We are not going to go into the details. But if you take the model of attention, how it works, how it affects the visual information processing, then probably the oldest and the most simple and well-supported model is the bias competition model. Now, it's very simple. So if you imagine that you have two stimuli in your visual field, they're going to be represented in your visual cortex. And what attention does, because these two representations are going to compete with processing resources, that has been shown, that there is a competition between these representations, the attention is just going to bias actually this representation. So it will increase the attended stimulus representation, which in turn will inhibit the other one. So you basically a bias, the attention is going to be as a bias of the competition between the different resource, different inputs in your visual environment. Now, what can be shown now is, I mean, there are a lot of demonstrations showing that this can be mapped with fMRI. This is again one of our earlier experiments where we showed that if there is a competition, just by training attention, you can bias this more strongly. And that's quite important for different other experiments. And if you have moving dots in two different directions, you will perceive it as a cloud moving in this direction and the other cloud. So just asking the patient, the participant to attend to this direction all the time, basically can bias and build in a bias in the brain processing, in the visual cortical processing for all the basically visual cortical areas for this specific direction. So just summing this up, by now fMRI become probably the most widely used technique for studying visual information processing in the brain. As you probably heard, it's getting more and more difficult to study monkeys, and all of the big, you know, monkey laboratories have been basically closed in Western Europe and the United States, with a very few exceptions. So basically now we shifted completely from doing research on monkeys to doing research on humans. It's non-invasive, and you basically can ask very sophisticated and important questions. Okay. Now we have something in Hungarian. Okay, so I will talk. So we go to the third part of our talk, which is actually about the application of fMRI. Should we have a break or I finish in half an hour, okay? Can you? Is it okay for you? So, as I said, the third big application field of the fMRI is clinical application in pharmacological studies. Now, it took some time to realize why it is important to study human brain, because at some point everybody was thinking, okay, we have good models, we have monkeys, we have rats, we have mouse, this is evolution, the basic ideas are the same, the basic constituting elements are the same. But it turns out that it's not the case. Of course, besides of the fact that brain diseases are the largest, you know, burden on the socio-economical, you know, budget, and it's the most critical component of, you know, human health, we also have to realize that human brain is completely different, or very much different from what we see in animals. Okay, this is very, but you have seen probably this kind of pictures. It's, let me show an example. Okay, so this is how the brain is developing with evolution. These are the numbers, they are falling apart, but the point is that there is a huge increase. So in the rats and in humans, so rat is the most widely used model for pharmacological and clinical studies, when we are talking about, you know, new medications and drugs and so on. So you can see this huge difference in just simple way. But even more striking is the difference between the number of connections. These are the number of cells, this is the weight, and I don't have connections. It's even harder. But the idea is that if you compare the heart of a human and the pig, you're basically gonna have difficulties to recognize which is the pig and which is the. If you haven't seen them, actually, if you are not a medical doctor, you will be definitely confused. Now, you cannot confuse a human and the sheep brain. So this is different, and this is different in many respects. And first of all, it's different in its abilities, in these major cognitive abilities. This is very important. We have human-specific cognitive abilities, which is then mainly connected to frontal lobe. It's language, it's the executive function, it's problem solving, personality, and blah, blah. Of course, you can You can find some of the traces of these functions in animals, and it's always a big debate whether, you know, dogs have emotions, dogs have, you know, language representations, blah blah blah. Of course, they have something, but you cannot compare to the diversity and the deep representations what we have in the frontal lobe in humans. No way. So if you have problems with this, and that's basically always the case when you are talking about neuropsychiatric diseases, they are not concerned very much about the early visual cortex, which is very similar to the visual cortex of a monkey. It's always somehow related to this frontal lobe and the associated limbic system. Now, why it is very specific again is because the human brain develops very slowly. So this has to be taken into the consideration. This was, you know, again, this is a new way of thinking about the brain. So as I showed you on these exams, the brain builds its own model about vision, about your visual environment, about the auditorium, and blah, blah, blah. So to build all these big, you know, detailed models of the world inside the brain, it takes time. So the rat can develop basically in 3 weeks. Now compare this to 20 years in humans. And this is top, so you can see in 20 years differences, developmental differences between the adults, say 35 to 45. And if they would have tracked further this age, I would say, yeah, they will even show further in 25. And then at 45 or so, everything starts to decay. So there is no constant, you know, there is no state of, you know, stability, basically. It's always changing. And that's about that's very problematic, because the developmental disorders, which you probably know, the autism, the ADHD, the attentional disorders, they all somehow related to the process of development. And again, which is striking, we don't really know how aging and whether aging takes place in a way similar to humans in animals. I mean, rats can, you know, live to up to 1 or 2 years. I mean, dogs can, but now it has been proposed that dog might be a good model for aging in humans, because they age quite slowly. So after years, like 10 years of age, they have a 2 to 6 years of decaying in different functions, which might mimic actually humans. But the most important thing that all these properties, all these features are quite selective to human. Yeah, what I mentioned, this is how cognitive aging takes place, or maturation and aging. So you can see that basically at 25 you can have peaks. From 25 to 45, this is the largest, you know, if you regard executive functions, reasoning, and spatial orientation, all these basically dynamic processes, then probably this middle age is the best with respect to performance, and there is a decrease. Now, verbal functions, they don't show this kind of decrease. They are sort of stable, and numeric abilities are quite good and preserved in them. Anyway, so what I'm just showing you that all these properties of the development aging require direct study of human cognition and brain processes. And this is a frightening illustration of, it doesn't concern you because you are too old, but anyway, if you think about that, by 2050, the whole population, you know, 2 billion people will be over 60, that's quite a shock, because, you know, it's one fifth or one or so of the population that we have. So, okay, it's important to study the human brain if you want to cure diseases of the human brain. So what you can do, you can use functional imaging to somehow connect the models what you have in animals and humans. And basically this is possible because you can use similar neuroimaging techniques in humans and animals. Now we have already rat MR systems, monkey MR systems. So basically the same experiment, the same setup can be used, or methods can be used in animals, and that can give you a good way to bridge somehow these two fields. Now, what is important in translational neuroimaging is basically, or translational research is what I just explained, but what is important that you try to do some biomarkers using the camera. Now, biomarkers are good because they will somehow give you a tool to identify a specific brain function and to track its, you know, development or disease progress, or whatever is you are interested in. So you can have a very direct measure of a specific brain function. Of course, now if you want to do a medication or you want to have a new drug, then you use this biomarker to measure the effect of the drugs, and you can basically infer the efficacy of this drug and so on and so on. As I already mentioned, that this human reach. So this is basically a scheme of how drugs are developed. So you have a discovery phase where, you know, you select the compounds, you select the target what you are trying to attack with your new drug, and then there is a preclinical phase when you have to develop and test these drugs in animal models, and have you have to be sure that this doesn't have any side effects, and so on and so on. And then it comes to the clinical trials where you actually apply it in humans, first on a small population, then it's a larger and larger population. This is extremely costly, so it can cost you many billion dollars for a drug just to take this clinical development stage. So the idea is somehow use fMRI in this early stage and try to decide whether a drug has a chance to be a potential, or a compound or a molecule has a chance to be a potential drug or not. And this has been, you know, now a major development, and almost all of the big pharmaceutical companies actually established their own imaging center, imaging facility. And I just wanted to show you that biomarker development, of course, a very, very difficult and time-consuming process. But anyway, all these indications, starting from Parkinson, Alzheimer's, depression, and pain, now it's an ongoing process, and fMRI is used to try to design these kind of biomarkers. And fortunately, there is another pressure on applying fMRI as a biomarker, which comes from the new regulations of the NIH. This is the National Institute of Mental Health. This was the early, and that's 2010-14. The idea is that the whole drug development process should shift from being symptom-oriented. So there's no way you can cure schizophrenia just by trying to stop delusions. That's already clear. That was the main direction. So somehow, you know, block the positive and negative syndromes of schizophrenia. That won't work. There were dozens and dozens of drugs which failed. That's the same for Alzheimer's, for dementia. So the idea is now you have to understand the neural basis of the disease. You have to have a good hand on it, I mean a good biomarker, which you can measure how the drug will affect this specific neuronal mechanism, this specific neural system. And as I mentioned in the beginning, at the moment it's only fMRI. So this triggered actually a big, you know, wave, and now neuroimaging and translational or pharmacological neuroimaging is probably the most developing part of the fMRI applications. And the earliest application, which now is considered actually to be accepted by FDA, that's the Federal Drug FDA. So that's FDA in US, the agency which legislates and gives confirmation for new drugs. And they are considering now accepting the first MRI biomarker, which is going to be a structural biomarker, it's not a functional, it's going to be the volumetric evaluation of the hippocampus. So this is the human hippocampus, you can measure it with MRI, with structural MRI, you can delineate it, so you basically you can reconstruct this three-dimensional representation of the hippocampus. Now you can compare the size, the symmetry, anything what you want now, you know, it's image processing starting from this. You can look for changes with aging and in dementia. And it turns out that there were these huge programs like the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative that if you compare to all other markers that can be used, it's PET, cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers or blood markers, it turns out that this simple method, just delineating the hippocampus and taking the volumetric, you know, hippocampus evaluation, gives you the best prognosis of a development of MCI, which is the step before, you know, Alzheimer's. That's the mild cognitive impairment stage from MCI to Alzheimer's. So now it's getting into the clinics, and this is going to be a very important, you know, component of the clinical examination and in pharmaceutical research. Yeah, it's just to confirm that now you can do monkey and rat, as I mentioned. This is monkey, this is rat, and you can nicely locate the default mode network, what I was talking, the housekeeper, which is active when you are not doing anything. And it turns out that the monkeys and the rat have the same. So again, this is translation. So now you can design a drug which actually affects the functional connectivity in these networks and measure it in humans and rats simultaneously and see what is the interaction. Now, just to give you a more detailed impression about how this takes place, let's take pain. How you can develop a drug for pain. This is a big pain to develop a drug for pain, and it has been so for, you know, 40 years or so. Because pain is one of those, you know, it's a state, it's not a percent. It's a very complex state. When you feel pain, it's actually a combination of basically the whole brain network and system level organization. So you have a direct component, of course, that's the nociceptor, that's the peripheral. When you feel something very hot, that's the input, it goes up. But how hot it is going to be for you, it will depend on all this system, like the cognitive set, whether you are expecting it or not. The level of pain can change, you know, by 40% just because you're expecting to have a pain, or you are just, you know, suddenly without expectation feels. It's much stronger pain when it's unexpected. So in studies, we perform this kind of studies together with Richter. It's strange. So if you have a patient that you know, for 1 hour, you have to induce small pain for them, they are desensitizing. So after a while, you know, they don't feel pain at all because they just simply predict it, they know it, and basically it goes away. But so you have this context, the cognitive set, the mood, how your emotional system also, and of course you have the chemical, you know, what are the hormone levels and blah, blah, blah. All this will affect your sensitivity of pain. And this is reflected on the so-called pain matrix or pain network. So if you can look at it carefully, you see, so starting from the subcortical regions, brainstem, thalamus, basal ganglia up to many different parts of the cortex, is somehow connected to feeling pain. Now, imagine that your task is to try to develop a drug to cure or to decrease the pain. So what would be your target? Of course, if you have a good way to desensitize your skin at the place where they're expecting the pain, that's okay. But if you consider that there is a patient with a chronic pain, which is very, very common. So there were some statistics showing that in older than 70 years, the population, about one-third has chronic pain. which means that basically they feel constant pain, and even those small stimulations which are not painful generally, they can cause pain for this patient. Now the biggest problem was that now they have, okay, the pharmaceutical company prepared the drug, they do the rat test, poor rats, they will be heated, you know, by panels, and they show a decrease of, you know, reaction. But in humans, what you can do, or what people have done, or pharmaceutical company, they took a sheet of paper and they asked these chronic patients to indicate from 0 to 10 how painful was it. So you can imagine how subjective this, you know, score is when a patient every morning, every evening has to give a number. I felt chronic pain, you know, the level 5. Now this was notoriously impossible to track, because after a while patients just, you know, 5, 5, 5, 5, they have this, we have this routine, blah, blah, 5. Then 2, 2, 2. Yeah. The sister or the, you know, the daughter came to visit this afternoon, it became 2, then she left, it became 8 suddenly. So all these unreliable scores were used for, you know, measuring drug effects in pain research. And we are talking about billions of dollars, so it's not a joke. So the idea was, is, okay, we knew that insula, this is insular cortex, so it's a very strange place in the brain, which is close to the early, you know, evolutionary early cortex and the evolutionary new cortex, the neocortex. It's a bridge between them. This insula is actually consistently was found to be activated when painful stimulation was applied. So it has been known for, and there were some studies, this is basic research, showing that, okay, the strength of the activation in the insula sort of correlates with how subjective the pain that has been, subjective pain that has been perceived, the level of the pain. So there were a couple of experiments, this going back to 2006, and I will tell you in the end why we have these old slides here. So there was an opioid analgesic, the amifentanil, it's known in the field. So what they tried to see, that depending on the concentration of the amifentanil, what they injected into the patients, and the same pain intensity stimulation, whether there is any correlation of the reducement of insula activation and subjective pain. And basically what you can see that higher the concentration you give to the patient of the remifentanil, the smaller the brain activation pattern as compared to the placebo, the saline. You see that it's strongly reduced and it's concentration dependent. And if you take insula, there is a nice reduction in insula. This is basically the subjective score. So this is how the pain reduces as function of the concentration of amifentanil. These were extremely, you know, successful first steps, and the whole, you know, industry started to shake up that, okay, we found something very important. Now you have to, of course, include controls. So it's nice that you can have the visual cortex, which is not to be involved in pain processing. So in visual cortex, actually you don't see any reduction of the responses as a function of the drug concentration, which is good because that means that you don't have a systemic big, you know, blood flow effect or overall, you know, effect of the drug. It's specific to the regions which are implied in the pain processing. So that was okay. So this was the first one. But when people started to repeat, or groups started to repeat these experiments, there were a lot of failure. You probably already heard about this, that there is now a big, actually, movement towards trying to somehow increase the consistency of the basic research finding and pharmaceutical research finding. So you can look into the newspapers and you will see that there were these big scandals and big problems that It's not only neuroimaging, it's genetics and molecular biology is the same, that the reproducibility of these findings was below 25%. Meaning that this is a basic research experiment, everybody got excited, then the big pharmaceutical companies, okay, let's do it, let's build a system like this, and let's use it as a biomarker, and most of the trials were failures. So it means that there was a big problem with the reproducibility of these results. So if we just conclude here, this is very promising, but we still have to go further and try to improve the methods. And now in the last couple of slides, I will just show you how you can do it. So basically it's promising for pharmaceutical and translational research, but you must improve the methodology. And now, what has been done? There are new sequences. What we call sequences, these are protocols which are run on the machine, on the scanner, when you acquire the data. And we were suffering a lot because of the resolution. And now with these new sequences, which is called the parallel imaging or multiband EPI, echoplanar imaging sequences, now you can reduce the resolution being like 3 mm by 3 mm in the spatial resolution, the temporal sampling is to half seconds. So basically in our center we have now a new scanner, which is a Siemens Prisma, which is the most advanced scanner which can actually be used for multiband EPI imaging. Now we use consistently not 3 but 2 mm with the 0.7 second sampling rate. So it's an order of, you know, it's like 3 times faster and better, 2 times better resolution what has been 4 or 3 years ago. So it's a big development and improvement. Now, what we are trying to do now, as I mentioned to you, the whole functional connectivity business and methodology is based on a zero lag correlation. Now, as if you have heard anything about signal processing, or you might immediately recognize that it's impossible that the signal in different brain regions would have a zero lag correlation for constant for a long time. I mean, this is biology. You don't have this kind of precise, you know, temporal timings. So we have proposed and we validated now a new approach which takes a well-known algorithm for signal processing, the dynamic time warping, and we applied it to functional connectivity. So instead of calculating correlation, now you can calculate dynamic time warping distance. It's basically adjusts for the possible small delays in between the two time courses. And it's much more robust and much, you can see here the robustness doesn't mean, I won't go into the details, but this is more robust than this. More blue is more robust. Or you can use this now for classification. So these are results from a public database where there were ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive, the attention disorder, and control groups. So basically using the dynamic time warping instead of simple correlation, so we and the literature before who tried this database were unable to classify based on functional connectivity whether the patient, it was a patient with ADHD or a control subject. You can see with DTV we were able to classify for 73%. Of course this is not 99%. So you have to improve still a lot, but these are very important steps forward. We actually now developed the machine learning algorithm, deep learning and convolutional neural network, which even adding to this can go up to 86-89% discrimination classification. So we are talking now about being able, just based on a brain scan, we are able basically save with quite certainty, so about 89 or something like that percent, that this child is going to have an ADHD or it's ADHD or not. So we are going towards a more robust and more sophisticated analysis of the data. And that's just the beginning. I mean, this is now the hottest topic, applying machine vision, deep learning to neural imaging data analysis. It's now the number one topic in the field. So that's gonna give you a big improvement in all this. Yeah, of course, you can use other approaches like trying to control for blood flow differences in aging and see neural differences, blah, blah, blah. So that's no end. But I also wanted just as the last slide to show you that that a very fascinating new approach in neuroimaging is actually the real-time fMRI control or feedback. You probably heard about neurofeedback a lot before because it's constantly present in the literature and the news. But these were more like, you know, trials and less successful trials, I would say, in the past. But with this new methodology, you really can do a real-time fMRI. That means that you can take a patient who has an addiction, that's just an example. You know that it's somehow related to the brain reward system. So there is a system in the brain which includes the striatum, the ventral striatum, amygdala, a couple of, you know, important regions, which is behind all these addictive symptoms. So it simply drives you too much towards some specific. It's the same for obesity. So if the overweight is very similar. So we did studies with Richter, and so if you show a picture of a high-calorie food and a looker, like a salad and a hamburger, you will see that your, not your, but the patients, they were, you know, with BMI more than 35, so obese people. Their reward system is lighting up. So they are going crazy about, you know, seeing a hamburger as compared to a salad. So you can take now this region, and with real-time neurofeedback, you start to deregulate the response to food cues or nicotine cues, or, you know, if it is alcoholism, then you can show vodka and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the point is that it's working. It's very much in the beginning. That now in the United States, there are a couple of private companies already who are trying to develop now this sort of service to down-regulate specific activation patterns in your brain which drive you in a non-appropriate or bad behavior response, which I think would be it's again non-invasive. It just takes, you know, 20 times you should come to an MR, be there for 2 hours, so it's completely harmless. If you consider that these patients are getting a lot of medications, you mean drugs and tablets, there are side effects, there are huge risks for everything, and this is completely non-invasive. You just lie down and you try, it's non-conscious actually. You get a reward when your reward system is not responding high, because there's always a variance. Because not responding high to a food cue, you get a reward. And it's implicit, so it's not conscious. It's going on like this for hours and hours, and the system is stabilized and it's going to be less response for you. Anyway, so this is not the far future, but it's an extremely nice application of these methods. Yeah, I think that's it. Okay. Anyway, so cool, okay? So, if you have any questions, sorry for the couple of Hungarian slides, I didn't know. Hogyha van bármi kérdés, nyugodtan kérdezzenek. El lehet jönni, tehát önök már hallgatták, van itt a neuroimaging kurzus. Jó. Szóval el lehet jönni a központunkba, meg lehet nézni, ha valakit érdekel, szívesen látjuk. Thank you. Visszaadom, jó? Mert azt mondta...
Köszönjük szépen, tovább viszont kapott viszont.